Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm so excited to be here with all of you today. I have a great show planned. My guest will be Andy Fisher. He's the author of a really wonderful new book called Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and the Anti-Hunger Groups. And I can't wait to have him come on and get into this conversation with him because it's really eye-opening what he's writing about. So stay tuned for his joining us in just a little bit. But before I do, I want to go on with some things going on around the city this weekend and coming up, and of course share my weekly recipe with you. Of course, this weekend is 4th of July, and there's so many events going on in the city. Some are foodie events, some are just 4th of July fireworks events. I think the best list is probably out on Time Out magazine, but check that out. And, you know, everyone has so many personal events going on this weekend that I think a lot of organizations choose not to do events on this weekend. So I hope you all have a wonderful holiday weekend. Those of you that get Monday off and really get a four-day weekend, enjoy it thoroughly. The weather is not in our favor for a lot of it, but I'm sure we'll all make the best of it. Some other great things coming up. Thursday, July 6th, Slow Food East End is having a community potluck dinner out at Bridge Gardens in Bridgehampton. And you can go onto the Slow Food East End website to find out information about that. July 7th, the Garden of St. Francis is having a ribbon cutting. They are kicking off their summer season with their farmer's market. They'll have wine, fruit, and cheese. It's free to go, and it should be a fun event on July 7th from 3:30 to 5, and that's in Belmore. Out on the east end in Jamesport, at Jamesport Manor Inn, there's going to be a rosé wine tasting on July 8th. And that is always fun. Rosé is really getting a big comeback, and they're going to be highlighting a lot of the vineyards out that way. Many of them are doing their wines in a sustainable manner, and so if you're interested in wines, this should be a fun event. It's $50 to $65 per person. And you can find out more about that on my website. On July 9th, there's a beekeeping event going on at the Brooklyn Grange. Brooklyn Grange is a rooftop farm. We recently did a slow food tour of the farm, and it's really such a wonderful place if you haven't been there. This is on Sunday, July 9th from 2 to 4 in the afternoon. And it will just, you know, it's just being led by the beekeeper, Karen Zinter, and she'll talk about why bees are so important, talk about honeybees, how to get started with your own beehive. It's probably late for this season, but you can always start and just wait a year to get your honey. But it's really worth raising bees if you have a place that you can do that or an interest, because, as you know, pollinators are in need of support, and they are at risk. And all of our food, or so much of our food, is dependent on pollinators. So anyway, that's going to be a fun event. July 12th, there's also a compost dinner up at Brooklyn Grange. That's from 6:30 to 9:30. If you go onto the Brooklyn Grange website, you can see a list of all of their events. Many of them are sold out, but I believe Compost Dinner still has room. And they're really looking to chefs nowadays to take on the issue of food waste and raise awareness about it. And this is an opportunity to see the creative dishes that chefs can come up with that are made from fruits and vegetables that otherwise would have been wasted or composted. You know, very often it's just a bruise, and so they can't sell it, or, you know, it's split open, or, you know, there's some sort, or it's the top of the beets that people think they just have to throw out, or the tops of radish greens that are all really delicious and can make great things with them. And so I was at one event, and they showed us how to make pasta from the tops of leeks, cutting it really thin and boiling it in water and using the leeks as the pasta, and it was really great. You put any sauce on it you want. So those are the kind of things that come out of a compost dinner, so check that out. July 14th to 16th, I'll be heading to Denver, Colorado, for Slow Food Nation. This is a big, big event. The last time the U.S. had a slow food nation was, I think, 8 years ago in San Francisco. But it's modeled after the every other year event that takes place in Turin, Italy, called Terra Madre. And slow food, for those of you listening for the first time and don't know me, slow food is an organization very close to my heart. It's about good, clean, and fair food. And it supports food that is good for the planet, the good that's good for your body. It supports people coming together and eating around a shared table, enjoying the pleasures of the table and the conversation that comes out of a good meal. But it's really supporting those that are raising food in a sustainable way. The people that pick the food should get paid a fair price. We should pay a fair price at the farmer's market for it. So it's all just such good stuff. And this big event in Denver will be highlighting chefs. There will be panel discussions, workshops. You know, lots of the city will be closed down. It will just be one big block party. So if you can get away, this is a place to get away too. So I hope to see you there. July 20th, I won't be able to go to this, even though I would love to go to this. So if any of you are not going to be in Denver and can go and represent yourself as an advocate for good nutrition, this is a workshop for nutrition educators so that they can prepare themselves and really go lobbying on Capitol Hill to support good nutrition in school lunch programs and the need for good nutrition. Right now, you know, the Food and Drug Administration is trying to back down on labeling foods. There's lead that has been discovered through the testing of baby food. It seems like, 20% of all baby food had high levels of lead in it compared to 14% of our regular food supply. And the reality is no lead in our food is good for us, and we really should get rid of that altogether. And so they really need to change those standards. But right now we need people to go and lobby on Capitol Hill and really promote healthy nutrition and school lunch program and get that to be better. As you know, our current administration is trying to back down on anything that the Obama administration put in advancing healthy lunches and moving our food forward. He's just trying to back down, cutting the EPA, cutting the FDA. It's just bad on so many different levels, and anything that any of us can do, we need to step up to the plate and do it. July 22nd, there's a Saturday summer workshop series going on at City Growers, and this, you know, there's many different workshops going on throughout the season, so go onto the City Growers website and find out about it. But this one is exploring holistic and homeopathic properties of herbs with Sarah Hurwitz, who is works for City Growers, and she's an herbologist. And you can learn a lot from her. So check that out. Save the date, August 11th, for the annual Food Truck Derby out in Bridgehampton. You know, I don't know how many food trucks come, but a lot of food trucks are there from all over the city and out east. And they meet in at the Hague Ground School in Bridgehampton, and it is a really fun event. So save the date for that. And there's lots more events on my website, but I don't want to take the time right now. So do check out events on my website at ieatgreen.com. Now I'd like to share with you my recipe. You know, I'm harvesting so many things out of my garden already. I had a few asparagus. I've planted like so many more asparagus now this year for next year. But I did have some asparagus, sugar snap peas, and garlic scapes. And then, of course, I threw in a mango. So this is a salad, a summer, a spring salad, fresh from the garden, and it's just delicious. So this is what you need. First, I made a lemon vinaigrette. I used a quarter cup of rice vinegar, a half of lemon, and it was a large lemon, so if it's a small lemon, use the whole lemon. A half a cup of olive oil, 1 teaspoon of honey, 1 teaspoon of fresh chopped dill, and salt and pepper to taste. And I just blended that in a little mini food processor. You don't use all of it. You only use like 3 tablespoons actually on the salad, so you'll have a little bit left over. For the salad, you need 16 asparagus stems, and you cut you break off the bottoms at the part where it's hard, and it will naturally break at the right spot. If you try to break the bottom, the part that is tough of the stem that you don't want to eat will come right off. And then I slice them on the angle so that they look really pretty and kind of about an inch and a half in length. 2 cups of fresh sugar snap peas, and those I cut into thirds as well on an angle. And for sugar snap peas, you know, you have to de-thread them. You have to pull off the little string from the top down towards the center and take the tough string off. Otherwise, when you're eating it, you'll have this fibrous piece in your mouth that you can't really eat through. So taking those off really makes it much nicer. 5 garlic scapes that I cut into 2-inch pieces, also on the angle. 1 mango cut into cubes. 2 cups of cherry tomatoes halved. 1/4 cup chopped fresh dill. 1/4 cup chopped fresh mint leaves. And I actually didn't chop them. Those I kind of rolled the leaves together and sliced them. So I had thin little strips of mint leaves. 3 tablespoons finely chopped red onion. And 1 cup of toasted walnuts that I toasted in a cast iron pan. Then I added 1 teaspoon of honey to that and let the honey melt in the pan and coat the walnuts. And added those as garnish on the top. So first I steamed all of the vegetables, each one separately, because they take a different amount of time. So I set up a steamer. First I steamed the asparagus. You take them out and you put them into a bowl of ice water, and that just blanches them, that locks in the color and the flavor, and then drain it and put it on a paper towel or a dish towel so it can dry. And do the same thing with the sugar snap peas and the scapes, each one steaming them, then blanching them, and then laying them out on a towel to dry. And then I toasted the walnuts, as I just said, and added the honey to that and made the salad dressing, and that's it. And then you're just going to combine all the different parts, the vegetables, the mango, and the herbs in a bowl, toss it with 3 to 4 tablespoons of the salad dressing, and then garnish with the walnuts on top. And it comes together relatively fast. It's so beautiful, so many beautiful colors, and it's just a great, early evening salad or lunch salad, whatever. It's just wonderful. Bring it to a potluck, and it'll make a lot of people very happy. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest to you. Andrew Fisher is the author of The Big Hungry, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. And Andy got his start back in 1994. He co-founded and led the Community Food Security Coalition, which is the first of its kind of a national alliance of hundreds of groups working on urban food access and local food issues. And he was the executive director of the coalition for 15 years, gaining momentum for the concept of community food security while building the food movement as a whole. And he was a successful advocate working on federal nutrition legislation and addressing food security issues. And he's just been working on that ever since. He's an activist, NGO consultant, and an adjunct teacher at the Portland University in Oregon. And his book, Big Hunger, is the launch for a new vision for how to untangle corporate interests from food banks and the anti-hunger movement. Andy, you with me?
I'm here. Thank you for having me, Bhavani.
Thank you. So your book is just, it's great. It's a whole new way of thinking of, you know, who could think anything bad of, you know, food banks and soup kitchens. And it just really gets you thinking about, once again, do I call it corruption or the, you know, it's not intentional, but the misinterests of different parties who are trying to do good and end up not doing so good. So anyway, maybe before we get into the book, maybe you can just share a little bit more. I did a little bit of your bio, but a little bit more of how you came to work on food issues. Like, how did you get passionate about that to start with?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I started at, I was a graduate student at UCLA in urban planning in the early 1990s. And I was more interested in Latin American issues, and I happened to be there at the time of the civil disturbances in L.A. following the acquittal of the officers
who had beaten Rodney King. And it just became really clear that the food system was not working in Los Angeles. You know, there were people burning down their grocery stores. It really became evident, you know, in the mainstream press that there was a lack of supermarkets in South Central L.A. So a group of my friends and I decided to kind of look at the food system as a way to, you know, for more kind of a grassroots community development approach rather than what was being proposed for big corporations to come in and provide jobs. And so we did a year-long study of the food system in L.A. and why there weren't supermarkets there, kind of why, you know, people talk about food deserts now. What were the health problems and what were the hunger problems and what were some of the solutions? And it just took hold. So that's how I kind of backdoored into it.
Uh-huh. And when did you first catch wind of the unhealthy relationship between corporate America and hunger groups?
Well, you know, I had a front seat at the anti-hunger table because my organization was part of something called the National Anti-Hunger Organization. Organizations. It was kind of like the main alliance of anti-hunger groups. So from the get-go, really, I mean, we had problems with, we were proposing some innovations in around kind of how the federal government would fund community food work. And we got a lot of resistance from national groups along those lines. And it wasn't really corporations per se, but, you know, it really became clear, say, maybe 10 or 15 years ago when you started to see Walmart showing up at the table. You started to see the main anti-hunger lobbyists really align themselves with big ag rather than with a progressive, sustainable agriculture community in the Farm Bill. So it was a barrier. It was a barrier from the get-go, really, for our work.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, you see these connections in so many different ways. I remember, you know, with the World Wildlife Fund, I was at a big conference, and World Wildlife Fund was in, working with DuPont, I think, you know, because they were getting their funding from them. And, you know, there's so many times where I think these big corporations can kind of greenwash their way into, you know, not having a guilty conscience of all the bad they're doing because they do this little bit of what they perceive as being good, and it's not really quite working. You talk about the hunger industrial complex in your book. Can you explain to us a little bit what the hunger industrial complex is?
Sure. You know, and I borrow from the famous phrase of military industrial complex. And that was what President Eisenhower said upon his departure from office back in 1961. You know, he warned us against this kind of unholy alliance between the defense industry and the military, and that they would promote bellicosity. They would, you know, promote war at the cost of peace because it would enhance their profits. You know, and I'm seeing the same thing in our context here with the anti-hunger community. You've got large corporations, mainly in the food and ag sector, whether they be Walmart, Kroger, or Tyson, or ConAgra, or Cargill, that have that cause a lot of damage to the environment, that don't treat their workers well, that are causing harm to public health, but they are the ones that are vacuuming up most of the public resources in terms of our federal food programs. You know, there's about $100 billion of federal food program money that we spend every year, and they receive the vast majority of that. They align themselves with anti-hunger groups in various different ways, whether it be through donating money and food to charity, and then those organizations such as food banks don't support minimum wage increases or don't support policies that would harm the economic interests of those companies, or they lobby hand in hand with anti-hunger groups in Washington to protect things like the continued ability of SNAP recipients, of food stamp recipients, to purchase soda and junk food. But as I was saying, you've got anti-hunger groups who are lobbying with the soda industry to protect their interest for food stamp recipients to continue to buy about $6 billion worth of soda every year. So you've got this web of connections where you've got the food industry sitting on the boards of food banks who then protect the interests of those companies, the economic interests of those companies, and enhance their reputation. So as a result, the result of that, just as, you know, Eisenhower said, we're promoting war at the cost of peace, is we're maintaining hunger. It becomes a hunger maintenance industry rather than a hunger elimination industry. So we're not doing enough, from my perspective, because of this unholy alliance, to really end hunger. We're just kind of perpetuating it because so many people are profiting, and so many corporations are profiting from its continued existence.
Have you gotten any backlash from your book? Like, are you making lots of friends with this book?
You know, everybody asks the same question. I'm getting a lot of positive comments. I'm getting a lot of people calling it brave and courageous, and they're saying it's a great read, and they're loving it. I am getting, you know, I'm getting a little bit of backlash in the sense of, some of my colleagues won't publicly endorse the book. You know, as I go around and do talks around the country, they won't sign on and let me use their name in sponsoring it or help me do outreach. But I'm not getting, you know, I'm not getting certified letters on my doorstep. I'm not getting, you know, a lot of public angst about it, mainly because I think the groups that are opposing it are staying silent.
Right. Sometimes that's a better way. They think it brings less attention to the problem.
Right. I suppose it's a wiser way of doing things in some ways.
Okay. So I get the connection, obviously, between, you know, junk food producers and anti-hunger groups. But what about minimum wage? You also talk about that food banks, that they won't advocate for an increased minimum wage. How would that affect the corporations that are donating money?
Sure. You know, and I looked at the websites and the Facebook pages and the blogs and annual reports of the 200 plus food banks there are in the country. And I found that only a handful are advocating for increases in the minimum wage. Out here in Oregon, Alameda County in Oakland, and, you know, there's a few others. And they're not doing it because it would alienate their donors, who tend to be very kind of bipartisan in nature, because a lot of their boards come from the corporate sector, especially from the food industry. The grocery industry is very well represented, as you might imagine, on the boards of food banks. So, you know, there's lots of instances in which food bank boards have held back food banks from advocating for those wages. You know, and especially if you look at the supermarket industry, it's very, very labor intensive, and it is very sensitive to increases in the cost of labor, and their profit margins are razor thin. So raises in wages affects their profitability very, very carefully, very closely, very dearly, I should say. So, you know, that is, you know, one of the main reasons why anti-hunger groups are not, or food banks are not going down that path. And I'll give you one example. In Washington, D.C., the city council passed a law, this is back in 2012 or 2013, conditioning the entrance of Walmart into the nation's capital on them setting a minimum wage of $12.50 an hour. So city council passed this bill, and you know, unfortunately the mayor vetoed it, and they tried to override the veto, but it didn't quite work. But in that process, there are a couple major anti-hunger groups in Washington, D.C., both of whom receive Walmart Foundation money. Neither of those organizations would stand up and support that piece of legislation, even though it clearly would reduce hunger in the capital, even though it clearly would provide workers with a, you know, if not a living wage, at least better than a minimum wage. And, you know, in one of those organizations would even showed up on a video on Walmart Foundation's website talking about how wonderful Walmart is as a corporate citizen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can... you know, it's a connection that I think so many people just never really thought about. And, you know, I always wondered, I was like, why are they lobbying for these soda bills to make it so that you can't buy soda with SNAP benefits, but they still would let you buy diet soda when, you know, from a health standpoint, diet soda is even worse. And now I understand that was their compromise, probably, you know, that they would support not buying sugary soda, but still, you know, it will make everybody buy diet soda, which in the long run is even worse for people's health. It might not have all the sugar, but your body doesn't know that because it tricks your body into thinking there's no sugar in. And it's just all the chemicals, and they're just horrible for you. So, you know, I talk very often about the connections. You know, our government is not supportive of keeping people healthy. I think if we went to a single-payer health system, they'd care more about it because it would be costing them money if people were unhealthy. Right. So all of a sudden it would save them money if they got people healthy. But right now, everything is tied around making money and keeping us sick in general, I think, makes all different kinds of industries money. So it's a complicated issue, isn't it?
It is. It is. And I think you're absolutely right about the ties around money and the incentives or lack of incentives that government has and other actors have.
Now, do you have any idea how much money, I'm sure you do, how much money is being spent with federal food programs in general? And what are your suggestions on ways it could be spent better?
Sure. It's about, it's somewhere between $85 to $90 billion a year is my understanding. You know, it kind of goes up and down every year depending upon, for example, the enrollment in SNAP and the food stamp program. You know, it's been going down a lot lately because the economy is getting better. So, you know, currently, you know, there's two things. Currently, it is unknown where that money is being spent for the most part. The SNAP program, for example, is not transparent. USDA will not release information on what products are being purchased with SNAP. They claim that is they don't have that information. And then where the money is being spent exactly is also kind of a secret. And USDA will not release that information. They've been sued by a newspaper out in South Dakota for that information. The courts ruled in favor of that newspaper. The USDA had to release what stores are receiving SNAP benefits and what amount. And the Food Marketing Institute recently prevailed upon the courts to delay that. They appealed that decision, essentially. So it's going up to the next level of courts. So for the moment, we don't know, you know, how much Walmart is making or Kroger or Safeway or other stores, and we don't know what products are being purchased. There was a recent, you know, USDA did publish a recent study from 2011 with data from 2011 from one supermarket that kind of gives us a sense of what's being purchased. And with a SNAP program, and it's not a whole lot different than what non-SNAP recipients purchase. They do buy, you know, a little bit more sugary beverages, a little bit less fruits and vegetables, but you know, it more or less follows the same patterns of what Americans at large buy. So you know, I think that we've got a problem now. I think we've got a problem in that most of that money, as far as we know, is really going into the hands of large corporations, whether they're food processors like
Our connection's not great right now, Andy. Can you go somewhere with a little better reception, maybe?
I'll go into a different room. Is this better?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay, all right. I just stepped outside. The money's being spent largely, you know, is going to large companies that, as I mentioned before, are causing a lot of harm to the environment, that are causing a lot of damage to rural communities, not paying their workers well. So I question, why is that happening? You know, those are not necessarily the values that we as a society hold. They're things that we're paying for as taxpayers. We're subsidizing corporations. For example, there was a study that came out in 2014 that showed that Walmart's low wages are costing us, us as taxpayers, over $6 billion a year in Medicaid and in food stamp benefits. So we're subsidizing Walmart's profits by $6 billion every year. So, you know, I think there's lots of models for changing that, that where more of the money could go towards small and medium businesses, the small and medium-sized farmers who have been shown to generate create more jobs, to reduce poverty, and who are more effective at, you know, filling tax coffers are than large corporations. So we should be, you know, we should be putting our money, we should be getting values for our money, not just value. You know, let's get away from the cheapness model and focus on a food system and support a food system that meets multiple social purposes, including protecting the environment and helping workers.
I'm just curious, can you explain a little bit more how we're subsidizing the Walmart with the $6 billion? I wasn't so clear on that.
Sure. Walmart pays its workers sub-living wages. And they oftentimes do not allow their workers to get full-time employment, but they manipulate their schedules to make it difficult for them to work another job. So as a result, what do workers do? They qualify for food stamps. They qualify for Medicaid. They qualify for other federal programs they wouldn't qualify for if Walmart paid them a living wage and gave them full-time hours. So
I get it.
As a result, the SNAP program, the food stamp program, is now more about a work support program. It's more about helping people who are working at low wage jobs make ends meet than it is about helping people who, you know, common perception is they're lazy, they're unemployed, you know, they're just lying around. That's not true. It's people who are working, you know, one or two or three jobs, but are getting paid such low wages and working such few hours that they need SNAP to make ends meet.
Yeah, I recently was just reading the statistics on how minimum wage has not increased in, is it the last 10 years or even more? Do you know?
I don't remember when the last time it increased, but, you know, the minimum wage peaked in 1968. If it had kept up with productivity, it would be at over $18 an hour now.
Right. So minimum wage basically has not gone up, and yet the cost of everything else, it has. Food's gone up 25% in the last, I think, 10 years, if not more. And
right.
So it's getting harder and harder for housing, yeah. You know, especially in the urban areas where so many people live, they're getting priced out of the market. And so it's a real tough situation. And, you know, we definitely have to start paying a livable wage and taking a look at that. We're going to take a couple-minute break, Andy. And when we come back, I really would love to hear some innovative examples of anti-hunger work that you see going on and ways that these anti-hunger groups could better use their money to really address the problem and, you know, promote changes to the food system. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Andy Fisher, author of The Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and the Anti-Hunger Groups. Be right back.
Your source for the best in progressive radio. Radio.
Hello, this is Cordelia Gafar. I'm the founder of Workout Around My Day and the Stressless Mom of Six. I have started the new Replenish Me radio show to help moms to have strategies to get through their day and to renew themselves throughout the day with little small self-care tips. And I'll be having interviews with self-love coaches, wellness coaches, just to help you. So join me Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and replenish you.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Andrew Fisher. He's the author of The Big Green. I'm sorry, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and the Anti-Hunger Group. And Andy, right before the break, I touched on if you could share with us some innovative examples of anti-hunger work that you see happening.
As much as I critique anti-hunger groups, especially food banks, for their corporate relationships, there's, you know, it is an exciting time in the anti-hunger world. There's a lot of change that's going on, and for much of it for the positive. We're seeing a lot of food banks are really improving the quality of the food that they're distributing. And there's programs such as here in California, the Farm to Family program, that is getting a lot of produce from the fields, and it's distributing it to needy families. So, you know, in some cases, you've got food banks that are distributing, you know, half to two-thirds of what they distribute is produce. So you've got, you know, the quality is improving dramatically in many food banks. You've got a lot of food banks that are moving more into the sustainability realm. They're operating community gardens. They're operating a CSA farm. They're even buying food from local farmers. You've got some that are supporting economic development. Up in Rochester, FoodLink is using its facilities to foster local businesses and to help kind of catalyze entrepreneurs to be successful by using their warehouse and their transportation. In northern Alabama, the food bank is using its resources to help local farmers to grow their businesses. So you've got a lot of great efforts going on in the food banking community. You've also got, you know, some groups like Just Harvest in Pittsburgh that is very entrenched in fights for economic justice and is doing some fantastic work and some fantastic organizing. You've got the Center for Good Food Policy, or Good Food Purchasing, excuse me, out of Oakland, that just got the city of Chicago to agree to its purchasing guidelines for its schools. So schools are now committing to these high standards of purchasing around nutrition and sustainability and even wages and labor. But, you know, the one thing that really gets me excited that I think is a great story is this group out in Ontario in Canada. And it's called Freedom 90. And Freedom 90 is a group of little church ladies who've been volunteering at the local food pantry for a long time, and they've been doing it for too long. They're tired of it. They want to retire. They don't want to be doing this forever. So they formed a union. And this union is what Freedom 90 is. And, you know, the joke is that they want to retire by the time they're 90. But they're trying to make food banking obsolete. You know, they're advocating to the provincial government to create a universal basic income, to increase welfare rates, to move public policy so that poor people don't have to rely on food banks. And I think that's exactly the right approach we need. You know, exactly the right thing is that we need to be moving away from charity and towards justice. And food banking and charity, you know, is not justice. It's what we do because there is no justice in the society. So that kind of, you know, grassroots organizing to me it really speaks volumes.
Uh-huh. That's great. You know, unfortunately, children very often are the ones that hurt the most in this system. Can you talk a little bit about childhood hunger and how this is affected by this relationship?
Sure, absolutely. You know, the as you mentioned, you know, hunger, food insecurity is hardest on children, in particular because of it affects their brain development, and because it also has, you know, learning, it can cause problems in school. If you're hungry, you're not going to pay attention in school, and lots of studies have shown that you're not going to do as well if your belly's rumbling. So, you know, there's some really very legitimate reasons to focus on childhood hunger. But at the same time, you know, I think where the anti-hunger community is kind of cherry-picking. They like to focus on childhood hunger because, you know, there's this concept in our society of the deserving and the undeserving poor. The undeserving poor are those who are lazy, who are immoral, who are shiftless, who have made bad decisions in their life. It's, you know, it harkens back to our puritanical roots, in which, you know, the poor are poor because of their own fault, essentially. So we in our society draw this distinction between the deserving and the undeserving poor, and the deserving poor, excuse me, are those who are poor because of no fault of their own. You know, such as children or the elderly or perhaps even veterans, you know, are ones we see as deserving of assistance. And so anti-hunger groups love to focus on children because it evokes our, you know, our sympathies, because it's much easier to fundraise around, because it's, you know, it's cherry picking essentially. But when they do that, when they, you know, organize backpack programs or when they organize school pantries or the like, you know, what they're doing is essentially is selling everybody else down the river. They're saying, you know, if you want to focus, we want to focus only on children. Well, what about the folks? What about the adults? What about the homeless? What about others who perhaps don't fit into that deserving poor category that we have? So it reinforces that dichotomy, and it makes it much harder for us to focus on serving the needs of everybody else.
Uh-huh. You know, where do you see anti-hunger organizations? Where should they be putting their energy? You know, I'm reading the book and I'm thinking, you know, every year I have a good relationship with the River Fund New York, which is a local food pantry. A good friend of mine started it, and he really understands poverty and knows that it's not, that these people are not lazy, and that it is not because they're lazy and they don't want to work. And he also understands that there's other circumstances that are causing them to be waiting on these lines for the food. So, you know, they do help them get the other services that they're entitled to, but then they also support, you know, pregnant moms. They get, you know, do baby showers and, you know, support them with things that they need, and then with after school programs. And then they also have a college scholarship fund for kids. You know, most of the kids will be able to get free tuition, but as those of us that do know, the people mostly drop out because they don't have money for books and for food while they go to school, right. And they end up having to make some money. And so even this, you know, new initiative that, you know, Cuomo did in New York State, you know, for free education for people making under 125, well, that's not going to change the reality for the poor people. They already were getting free tuition, but it's, you know, there's still no money for their books, their food. So they're still going to be dropping out at the same rate because there's nothing to address that. And so anyway, so this food pantry that I work with understands that and supplements those things so that the kids don't drop out. And they just last year had their first graduating class, and, you know, they're doing great work, but they still have their food pantry and, you know, provide food for people. And so I've been organizing for over 20 years. I feed the homeless during Thanksgiving and Christmas, like so many others, you know, during the holiday time. And but I get over 100 people that come through my home volunteering and cooking. And I'm just thinking, what other things should I, you know, I'm still going to do this event because I'm kind of locked into it, even though I too would love to retire from it. It's so much work. But what other things can I be having people do when they do come through my room? Should everyone be signing on to petitions or writing letters, or what kind of advocacy work could we be channeling this energy to that would be more productive?
Right. No, it's a great question. And it sounds like that food pantry is doing some amazing work. I mean, they're doing things in a very comprehensive fashion and treating the whole person rather than just saying, here's a box of food and be gone with it.
Yeah, you. They know every family. It's really amazing. Yeah, they know every family.
And that's a great example of a way to, you know, of the relationships that need to get built to help people in a more comprehensive, kind of holistic way. You know, I put the onus back on the organizations themselves, on the anti-hunger groups themselves, and especially the food banking community. And I say, okay, you know, we've been doing this for 35 years. Things just keep growing to the point where now food banks are distributing $5 billion worth of food every year. It's kind of snowballed out of control. This isn't what was intended when food banks were started back in the early 80s. And so let's set some goals. You know, let's say in 20 years, just to pick an arbitrary number, 20 years, we don't want to be doing this anymore, right? So by the year 2037, we want food banking to look very different than it is now. Maybe it only takes place when there's a natural disaster or high unemployment rates. Or it's more relationship oriented, like you're talking about. Or, you know, there's always going to be waste in the system. Let's get that food waste to institutions that need it, whether they're schools or domestic violence shelters or homeless shelters. But let's set some benchmarks. So within 5 years, maybe we're putting 10% of our budgets as food banks into policy advocacy to move upstream, to start focusing on increasing wages and improving SNAP and affordable housing. And let's, you know, set some benchmarks and get ourselves up along that way. So that's the vision that I think food banks need to put out there to really transform themselves, you know, to have that long-term strategic plan. And, you know, as a society, we need to educate ourselves, and food banks and anti-hunger groups need to educate us. They've been telling us for years that the solution to hunger is, you know, throw a few cans into a food drive. We all know that's not the case. But that's been the message, and there's been some, you know, miscommunication along the way. So there needs to be redirection. There needs to be, you know, I hate the term re-education because it makes me sound like, you know, Khmer Rouge re-education camps. But I mean, I think the point is that we need to, you know, we need to be telling people the truth that, you know, we're not going to end hunger with food drives. We need to do the hard thing. We've done the easy stuff. We need to do the hard stuff. We really need to be raising wages and providing people with whole sets of services to get people out of poverty. So it's going to require, you know, a comprehensive redirection, not just in the private sector, but also the public sector. There's going to have to be redirection in the way we spend our federal food dollars and increased effort on wages and increased effort on housing and healthcare and all those things that help people lift themselves up.
That's very general. Is there any organizations that you can, you know, rattle off to my listeners where they can go and put some of their energy or some of their dollars that would put them put the money in the right place?
Sure. You know, Why Hunger, I think, is a fantastic organization. They're out of New York. They do a lot of work in building kind of networks of community groups that are focused on self-reliance and racial and economic justice. That would be one of the main ones that I can think of. That'd be probably the top the top organization I would mention.
Great. I get their emails. They are a wonderful group. Okay, so what? Tell us about your book. What are you doing to? Do you have any readings coming up in the New York East Coast area?
Yeah, I'll be back out in the East Coast in October. I've got a talk at Queens College on October 4th. I'm organizing some other ones around New York City and upstate New York in the first week of August. I'll be in Philadelphia the last week of September, in Baltimore and Washington around that time as well. And then I'm hoping to get into Connecticut in that period as well. So the only firm date I have at this point is the one at Queens College, but I'm working everything else and should have things together within a few weeks.
Good. Well, I certainly hope to see you when you're here.
That'd be great.
So as far as food waste goes, do you feel like it's, you know, that the food bank should still continue gathering food that's, you know, while they're trying to address some of the advocacy things, are they doing a good job of helping people, or do you think in long, it's more hindering people by providing food in this way?
I think it's both. I think, you know, that we're certainly in a situation where the emergency food system is necessary. It's not something I would advocate needs to go away immediately. And, you know, people are in need, and they run out of money, they run out of food, and food pantries provide a crucial service to over 40 million people a year. So that is, you know, it's something that, you know, still provides and adds a lot of value to people's lives, and is a kind of an, it's a safety, it's the safety net under the safety net. It's, you know, because our public safety net, our food stamp program and our welfare programs have been so shredded over the years, that we need to have this private system kind of function underneath that, really, is unfortunate, but it is necessary. So that's, you know, it's a good thing on that level. The bottom line is good. I think sometimes the process is not all that pretty. You know, I've volunteered in food pantries before and heard from a lot of people, that they feel like that the process by which people get food is not always a positive experience. It can be very harmful to people's dignity. It can feel very racist or classist. It can feel that there's this power dynamic of when you're relying on charity, you know, you become, you have less control over your own destiny. You know, you need to take whatever you get, perhaps. It doesn't necessarily help one lift oneself out of their own situation, and to have to rely on that constantly becomes a death by a thousand cuts to one's dignity and one's soul. So, over the long term, I think it's a harmful system that isn't liberating people. It's more about, you know, redeeming the giver rather than it is about liberating the receiver. Meaning that, you know, the organizations and the companies that give to it and that get the tax credits and the donations feel good. It makes them feel good. But the folks who are the recipients, you know, they're kind of the pass-throughs. They're not really the intended beneficiaries of the system.
That's sad. Yeah. That's unfortunate, but I hear what you're saying, and you know, I feel very fortunate that this one food pantry that I'm affiliated with is so not that. I mean, you know, they've become a family for their whole community. You know, they've become the place where kids go after school to hang out so that they have good role models around, and the kids start volunteering, and you know, they grow up within. I mean, the sad thing is that I do see some of the same people coming who have been coming for 20 years, you know, and I've watched their kids grow up, and yet many of them end up working at the food pantry and within the food pantry, and they are treated with dignity and have found love, I think, from the food pantry. You know, it's given them a source of strength, which, you know, becomes like a community center. Which I think if a food pantry is doing the right job, that's how they should be.
Yeah, that sounds like, again, it sounds like a wonderful example, and it sounds like they're using food as an organizing tool to provide many other services. And that's really, that's ideal. That is, you know, food is a great way to build community. So that sounds like a wonderful place.
Uh-huh. And do you think signing petitions and sending things to senators and congressmen, do you think that does anything, or people, you know, or that's kind of, you know, just almost a waste of time that we really have to roll up our sleeves and take it on?
No, I mean, I'm a huge believer in public policy change, and I've seen it. I've done a lot of advocacy around multiple farm bills and child nutrition acts, and I've seen how, you know, a few well-placed calls and letters can really make a difference and help move policy. So I am absolutely, you know, I think that's absolutely the way to go. I think that, you know, there's obviously better ways and worse ways of doing policy advocacy. And that chain petition. It's nice, but you know, does anybody do? It doesn't have as much impact as a personal letter or a phone call to your congressman. So you know, it's there's like I said, there's better and there's good ways and there's better ways of reaching your congressman. And anything that's more personal, whether it's a visit when they're home in their district, or whether it's, you know, like I said, a phone call or a personal letter, those type of things are, you know, tend to be much more effective. Anything that reinforces that personal connection with your legislator is much more powerful than, you know, just a bulk email.
Right, of course. Well, Andy, thank you so much for joining me. This has been really informative and very eye-opening, and I think for most of my listeners, you know, it's something that you don't, you know, it's a different way of thinking of the anti-hunger movement, and it makes so much sense. And so thank you for opening my eyes, and I'm sure many others, and I look forward to, you know, working on this advocacy in my life, and I hope many others listening, you're willing to do the same, because we definitely need to work towards food justice and, you know, equality for everybody. So thank you, Andy.
Sure. Thank you for having me. And, you know, again, it's just a story of good intentions gone awry. But thank you.
Can you share your email or website where people can get in touch or hear more about what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're interested, I have a website. It's www.bighunger.org. I have a monthly newsletter that folks can sign up for. And, you know, the book is available through the usual sources, usual bookstores.
Yeah. And I'll have all those links, everybody, on my website, too, if you didn't get it down. So check back by tomorrow. They'll all be up there. Okay, Andrew,
okay. Thank you
so much. Everybody out there listening, thank you so much for tuning in to IE Green with Bhavani. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.